This is Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into Health Cetera. Today's guest is M.K. Zerwick. She is an author, a graphic novelist, a registered nurse, and she's also a senior fellow at the Center for Health Policy and Media Engagement, a colleague and a friend. When some people think about graphic novels or comic books, they automatically picture superheroes. Well, in my world, M.K. is one of my superheroes. But it's not just about superheroes. Comics have a long history around public health messaging, political activism, memoirs, great storytelling. And they also can be a way for us to enter into and engage in storyline that makes it easier to do so. M.K. Zerwick is here to talk about her new graphic memoir, Taking Turns, Stories from HIV/AIDS, Care Unit 371. You'll hear more what that is and why the title. It does take this graphic novel to help us enter a difficult subject, really about the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the early 1990s and in some parts of the country earlier. I was in New York City in the early 1980s working at a hospital, urban hospital here, and actually saw it as well firsthand before we had the medications to treat and have people live longer lives with HIV/AIDS. We'll talk about that too, I hope. For a younger generation who may not know the history of HIV/AIDS, this is a history book. And for all of us, it's a way to reflect on the atmosphere during that time so that we never forget the stories. Welcome to Health Cetera, M.K. Zerwick, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So we've talked about your other work. You've been a guest on our program. And I wanted you to speak first, if you will, to the title, Taking Turns. Why this title?
Well, the title arose from a comment that one of the doctors who co-founded the unit made that I do include in his portion in the book. He's a character in the book. And he said something like, the thing that made this unit special was that we all understood that we're all people taking turns being sick, whether I'm the patient today, the nurse tomorrow. You know, the divide ultimately between patient and provider is an artificial one, a necessary one, but an artificial one, because we all will one day be patients. In particular to this unit and to the AIDS crisis, we were taking care of our own in a lot of ways. Sometimes people who worked in the hospital were patients on the unit, or happened to work on the unit were patients on the unit. There was this real blurring of boundaries between between patient and provider. And I think it also echoes some of the themes just generally that I wanted to sort of, the way different patients would take turns in the same bed when you work in a hospital. Just different sort of themes that all seem to come back to this idea of we're all taking turns.
Mm. Wow. So true. And this dance, if you will, this choreography of, I'll use the word boundaries, which you didn't use, but where we are maybe less so now, but raised in our education as health providers to be clear about your needs versus the patient's needs and the family's needs. And yet, it's not such a clear line. And in every encounter, we often find ourselves having full hearts and reactions. And what it means to become the rookie nurse to the more experienced nurse is learning to trust some of that dance, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an issue that I explore a great deal in the book, because the book is kind of the story of me being exactly a rookie nurse trying to figure out in this very different, unique environment what those boundaries meant. And I, you know, so informing the book is an oral history that I did about the unit. And so many of the people I interviewed show up as characters in the book and sort of say things in relation to these questions that this young nurse has. And one of them is a social worker who had gone to school at the University of Chicago and felt that it was very clear, these boundaries were very clear. And he talks about stepping on the unit and thinking, oh, there's a huge problem here. Mm. And then we watch him evolve as he realizes what that moment in time required of people. And also this idea that I kind of alluded to is that those boundaries were pre-crossed. You'd have someone who was a friend who happens to be a patient on the unit. You can't go backwards from that.
Right.
And as you say, that, you know, that's not... that's part of the project, the product of that moment in history. But also, I think, you know, as you allude to, we make these kinds of decisions. We get very close to our patients. And, yeah, it is. And then later in the book, I talk with a therapist about how do you take care of yourself so that you you aren't more vulnerable than you need to be to that kind of boundary crossing that's not good for you
right.
as a caregiver. And then also, you know, I remember that in the book, as I step on the unit and I'm being interviewed by the nurse manager, she really kind of starts that ball rolling by saying, yeah, you know, you learned in nursing school you never sit on the bed. Well, that's not true here.
Mm.
This is a different environment.
I loved her.
Yeah.
And I also love the fact that you share your own path to deciding to go into nursing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? I know we don't want to give away too many of the high points of your beautiful book, Taking Turns, Stories from HIV/AIDS Care Unit. I should mention the publisher, who is the Pennsylvania State University Press, and it's just been published in March a couple of weeks ago. So we got you hot off the press, MK.
Tell me what the question was again.
your influence to go into nursing.
Oh, right. So my mom had been a nurse, and so I was absolutely raised making hospital corners and, you know, I and how to do sterile technique. You know, not that you need to do it around the house, but when you're my mom, you might. And anyone who's raised by a nurse knows what that's like.
Wash your hands.
Exactly. And everything has to be, you know, properly organized. And, but I resisted that, of course. You know, we don't want to be our moms at some point in our lives mm-hmm. and until we're older and we appreciate them so much. And so I resisted it. And I wanted a place in the arts. I wanted to be part of the world of the arts. I loved literature. I studied that in my first undergrad degree. But then, of course, couldn't, you know, get a job doing that. But what we'd been doing for a while was taking care of my father, who had had multiple strokes. And he really was completely dependent on the family caregivers, my mom and my brother and I. And so I also, after I graduated college and couldn't get a job, I knew that this was something I would be really good at. And I'd be able to get a job. And I'd be able to make a contribution when I felt like I wasn't doing that. So that's when I decided to go back to nursing school.
Well, so many good reasons, and so wonderful that you have now, in addition to your experience working as a nurse on the unit, on Unit 371, and subsequently I know you're teaching, and you've integrated your love of art and literature. I want to take a moment to step off the story of your book and be honest with you about my own. You've really introduced me in the most profound way into the world of the graphic novel and into the world of the use of graphics and comics. I know that you're the first nurse to publish a book in graphic as a graphic novelist, and so here's my moment of truth. I'm not really sure whether to look at the words first or look at the pictures first. So where should my eyes go? I've read your book, but I wondered that throughout. Is there a guide to this kind of reading?
You know, it's funny. I think it depends, too, on the style of the artist. Sometimes, I mean, I worry the same thing that I'm missing a point when I read graphic memoir or graphic novels. And I only read, you know, nonfiction, health-related, generally. I mean, I read a little more broadly than that, but I don't read superhero stuff, so there might be a different answer for that category.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I think you do what's most comfortable for you and what resonates with your brain. Sometimes it's hard because so much is coming at you on one page in a graphic memoir, and it's not as linear, necessarily. I think I tend to think in a linear way, so I can tell you for my book, generally you can read top, left, across, you know, pretty straightforward. And I think, there's a few pages where I mix it up and you could kind of mix, read in different order. But I think that you just do what works for your brain. And, you probably got the point of the book. You managed to do it.
Yes.
The thing, you know, Art Spiegelman, who created Mouse, said
yes.
that a graphic novel is a book, is a comic book with a spine that wants to be reread. And that's the other thing. I think, you know, you can sit down and read my book in an hour. But I think part of it, the relationship is to go back and kind of then look for cues you might have missed. Look, you know, read it again. Look for, and I say this not just of my book, but all of them. There's an amazing graphic novel or graphic memoir by David Small called Stitches. And it's about his growing up and having some throat surgery, and it's a much more complex story, but I don't want to give it away. But that's a book that you just could read over and over and over, and every time you look at it, you're going to find something new. And I think that's part of the charm, is that just to kind of free yourself and know you don't have to take it all in on one swipe, right? You read, I think we read for plot the first time through, but then you can kind of go back for more nuance another time.
Well, you're actually describing my experience, because I did read it the moment it came in the mail and sat down and read it, and I've left it out next to my computer, and I've been flipping through it every once in a while, and actually anyone who comes to our kitchen table picks it up. And there are these many quiet moments in the book. I want to talk about that. There are moments where I felt like I had to stay on the page longer than the page before and reflect on what I read and saw. And as I mentioned in our opening, I too worked with this community in the early 80s, mid-80s. I'm fresh out of nursing school as a rookie. In those days, floated to a unit where there were 19 and 20 patients, all with multiple, at multiple stages of dying. No one was making it off the unit. Very few went home, but it wasn't a hospice unit. It was kind of like a medical critical care area. I was so inexperienced and terrified that I was going to kill somebody. And so there were moments for that, of that kind of self-reflection as a nurse, but also moments of just beautiful love. And one moment, and particularly because we talk about dying, and as nurses experience the process of dying with people and their families, where Tim asks you, one of the characters, what's it like when you die? And I kept going back to that page. So will you talk about the creative process of what it was like to even write that and remember that? And how did you remember? Were you journaling during your time on Unit 371 and have such access to these memories?
I was keeping kind of written records. You know, part of it was I was just trying to figure out, you know, like you say yourself, as a young nurse, how do you get through this, right? I mean, how do you kind of stay connected after all that we bear witness to? And for me, yeah, I started out writing in journals and just kind of making notes and just kind of holding on to, in some ways, things I wanted to remember, but also needed to walk away from, because then you have to show up the next day and be present to those other six patients, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah, it was partly that I kept all that those notes. And I'm really glad to hear that you say that there are these moments of quiet that kind of require you to sort of pause, because I think that's part of the beauty of the medium. Unlike a film, which sets the pace of experience for you, the nice thing is that with this kind of medium, you can just take it at your own pace, right? And you can relive it at the pace you want to when you go back. And I really built those in intending for that to be the case. So I'm really happy to hear that that was your experience.
Yay. Interesting you should talk about it as in a reference to film. One of the sites that I was reading to prepare for our interview was on a site for librarians, and there was a reference to the fact that the combination of text and image is the closest thing to 20th century medium of film, and that the visual text and the creation process has in it similar storyboarding as would be in creating a film.
Right, yeah, a storyboard for a film or an animation looks exactly like a comic, yeah.
The other thing about comics, if I can share, is when I was growing up and learning how to read, or maybe had already started to learn some words, I remember, like, when the newspaper was finished by my parents, I would run to the funnies, and there were a lot more of them, and there were a lot more print newspapers in those days. I grew up in a family where we had multiple newspapers delivered to our home, and I remember just kind of what it felt like to be able to probably then relying first on the graphic and then the words, but how important it was for my reading literacy and the role that graphic novels and comics do that in promoting this sort of visual and verbal literacy. So it seems as though schools are beginning to integrate the graphic novel and memoir and historical books more and more into the curriculum. And you teach, do you use the graphic novel in your teaching?
I definitely use, one of the primary things I teach is graphic medicine, which is what we kind of call this whole field, this whole area, graphic health. And it's a subfield in the health humanities or the medical humanities. We're still sort of negotiating that transition between medical to kind of be more broad. But yes, absolutely. So that's kind of my specialty area. So that's what I will use. And you know, your comment makes me think, too, about there's a different way you will explore a thought or an experience or a memory or something you're grappling with if you actually draw at the surface of those ideas. And I think we talked about this the last time we talked. But I think it happens the same way for the reader, that, yeah, the image is going to do some different work in your brain than the text. And to put those two together is very powerful.
The color of the book, which I know we're talking on radio, so we can only use our words for the listener's imagination. There's a real softness but boldness to the choice of the art and the coloring. And I know from other, authors who are also creating their own art for their book that it doesn't always feel like they got it. But tell me, do you feel like your publisher and the quality of the paper and everything about it, they got it?
I really was absolutely thrilled when I got, I was so nervous because, you know, I had this strong sense of responsibility representing this experience because it's not, it may be my memoir, but it's not really about me. You know, it's representing a much larger experience of a much larger community. And I, you know, that was one thing that was out of my control as much as I talked with them. And one of the reasons I was so thrilled to go with Penn State University Press was I'd seen their previous books and I could tell they really cared about the book as an object in the world. And this is the object for me that's going to contain these memories. So, of course, I had just high expectations of it, and it did not disappoint. They did a beautiful job. Yeah, the weight of the paper is right. The color palette is exactly as it appeared for me and I intended it. I was very careful, and I use color in places, I think, to make up for sort of some of the deficits, perhaps in my ability to convey information accurately with my drawing style. And so I use color very intentionally, and it was important to me. And even just from everything to the inside, you know, cover design or the French flaps, I think that's what they call them.
Yes.
But just, yeah, the work they did on the book is just beautiful, and I could not be happier with it.
That's incredibly good news.
Yeah.
I'm also curious about, you know, for people who want to go and go to a bookstore and support a bookstore, you know, I know we can purchase it online and people know how to find that. But in a bookstore, where is a book like this placed? Is it placed in the health section? I'm curious what genre they put your book in.
Well, you've touched on, I think what is actually an enormous issue that we're trying to navigate, I say we because I mean kind of graphic medicine more broadly, is that it seems that the books in the graphic medicine series and the books on health and illness tend to end up in the graphic novel section, which is cool. But what I'd love to see, and I'm going to be traveling to more and more bookstores as I kind of move around the country and look for it, I would love to see this book appear in the memoir section or in the health section. Mm-hmm. If there happens to be an AIDS and HIV section, it seems like the book, since it covers many registers, it would be appropriate to appear in different places in the bookstore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, listeners, when you go to look for M.K. Zurich's book, Taking Turns, Stories from HIV AIDS Care Unit 371, especially your neighborhood bookstores, which we really encourage everyone to support, have that conversation. Hopefully you'll find it there, and if not, they'll order it. But certainly it is an important part of education for all of us and for myself included. So would this book be in a comic book store as well?
Well, that's the other question. So I'm not sure that comic book stores are sure this is the kind of book that would appeal to all readers. But I would say absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would absolutely think that hope and expect to find it in a comic shop. So that's, you know, that's the graphic novel for adults on serious topics is really kind of finding its place. And that's kind of the work of, like you say, people who go to the stores and say, you know, I heard there's this terrific graphic novel about Parkinson's disease, mm-hmm. for example, called My Degeneration by Peter Dunlop Scholl. Terrific book. And it should be in the health section, you know, and it should be in bookstores. But also, you know, people, adults shop for comics and may have an interest in this area. So, you know, we've been kind of just trying to get the word out to say these books exist and we think they're a tremendous resource for so many populations, and we're hoping that they become available.
Yeah. So let's go back to your book and seeing yourself in this book and that person from 1994 who you tell us the story, and you bring us further than 1994, and we'll let the readers find it themselves. How was it reflecting on that nurse and who you are today? What did you learn more about yourself, or what can we learn more about ourselves when we do this kind of experience as creators? And looking back, again, the historical piece, the stigmatization that's raised in here, the plight of loved ones dealing with the dying, the fact that people were dying and there was one day a change because of an availability of protease inhibitors. But for you, M. Kayser, what was it like going back and creating this, thinking of yourself as that rookie nurse?
You know, I think what's interesting is I had so much compassion for that younger person, that younger version of me. And I, you know, I think probably a lot more compassion for myself than I had in that moment, right? Mm. Because I think in that moment I was like, why can't I get it right? What am I doing wrong? And I look back and, you know, now, of course, you look back in hindsight's 2020, you can see the full picture of what that person was struggling with in the context of the larger experience, and you can say, like, it's going to be all right, you know. And I think that's part of why I had some of the other characters who were supportive of me kind of saying that, almost to say that, you know, in my own words back to that character, I think just to try to, you know, the patience piece. So I'm really struck, as you asked the very insightful question, that my response instantly is like, oh, I just felt so bad, you know, for everyone in that bad situation, mm-hmm. including, you know, feeling a lot of compassion for my own struggle.
Yeah, I know the sense of the newness of being a nurse has been talked about and written about, and it's this club that nurses can all visit when we, you know, complete our studies and our scholarship as undergrads and pass our NCLEX, and then we're on the unit, and then it's like, oh my gosh, now I have to, you know, fortunately now they have these 6-week residency programs and you're mentored. I think some very fine hospitals, particularly magnet hospitals, have a residency, and, you know, it's not as though any of that maybe a sense of novice nurse has completely gone away, but I think they've recognized that more is needed. And in 85, when I worked here in New York City in an urban hospital center, there were those stories. There was one person in particular who I knew well and took care of, whose family didn't know he was gay or that he was hospitalized for HIV/AIDS. And he didn't want them to know. So you share one of those stories also in holding the confidence of those folks who had lived that experience. What was that like for you?
Well, I think, you know, the sense was that we would be this patient's ally no matter what. And yet at the same time, I can remember Dr. Blatt, who co-founded the unit, talking with his patients about considering having those conversations just to lift the burden of secrecy. Because when you're the one keeping the secret, you don't really realize how heavy that burden is. Whether it's, you know, about the HIV status alone or the whole thing, just that in terms of people making peace with their own lives and in that case, in those times with their death, why should you carry this burden too? So, you know, it was sort of this balance of, we will support you no matter what, but let's talk about what that burden is doing to you.
Yeah, yeah. Are you in touch with any of the people from Unit 371, and have they read the book?
I am. Because I did the oral history, I've kind of got a connection to a larger number of them than I would probably normally. And I have spoken to the person I've heard back from, and it's just been out for a little while, but the person I have already heard back from is Karen, your favorite character, the nurse manager of the unit. And it was such a relief. I don't think I'll ever forget the moment when I looked down at my phone and saw her email that said that she had just finished and she was really happy with it and felt that I'd represented the place well and told the stories well. And that meant the world to me because it's, you know, the issue of representation was really important because, you know, this certainly is by no means any definitive history. It's just, you know, the first story. I quote Lin-Manuel Miranda in the end of the book to say, you know, this is one story of this time. What other stories are there? And I hope that really, for those of us who experience this time, as you've shared, it's a chance to talk about that time and the struggles and that moment. And so it was always important to me to represent it well. And so I hope to continue hearing that, that people felt like I did my best and then hear their stories. And then for the people who, I mean, I really had two people, you know, kind of groups in mind as I made the book. As I said, the group who had been there, but then the group who hadn't, for it to serve, once again, not as a definitive account of what that was like, but an entry point. And I hope that the graphic medium makes that an appealing entry point to then go, you know, read Angels in America or watch Angels in America and The Bad Played On, learn about, and nonfiction. I'm currently reading David Francis, How to Survive a Plague, which is different than the movie, which is amazing, all the archival footage there in New York. But the book is even amazing as well. It's different. It's very narrative. It's an amazing story of kind of that birth of activism in this environment. And so I wanted my book to serve as an entry point to young people to see how much there is out there and to kind of explore this time.
And is the Illinois Masonic Medical Center still exist in Chicago?
It does. It does. It's the Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center now, and they actually are going to be hosting an event in April and their bioethics grand rounds to kind of talk about the book and honor this time and this place that happened in the hospital, and I'm very grateful for that.
Well, congratulations, and they have a lot to be proud of because you did them right. And of course, it is your story, as you say, and it's not meant to be. There's a journalistic approach to it that I felt when I was reading it because of the role of narrative in telling the story in the history of that time through the your personal memoir, but also some of the ways that you have captured the quotes by the people who you worked with as well as some of the patients that you cared for and their families. I also love, just to give away one other little piece, is you went and made art with one of the people you cared for that you befriended. And that was another quiet moment for me. I went back a couple of times there. Like, here you are, you made art part of the story in taking turns, stories from HIV/AIDS Care Unit 371. And in the story, you are making art with someone whose art is very much a part of their life. And I don't know, that almost felt like I could have swam in that space for quite a while. What was it like for you to actually make art with the person in the story?
Well, the patient characters are hybrid characters, and so that's a somewhat fictionalized event, or account of real events. But so to the spirit of it, yes, I absolutely did that, and it was a great joy of my life. I look back on the relationship I had with the person that aspect of the story is based on. And I just look back on it so fondly. You know, I would never change anything in that moment. But in terms of, you know, integrating the art, that felt so much a part of the culture of the unit that I wanted to communicate as part of what made it unique. And that's why the oral history I included from the art therapist, Russ, is such an important part of the book, because it really sets that tone for, you know, when I tell that story I share that story he tells, where a piece of art that a patient made became a piece of diagnostic information shared with the physician. I have a great deal of respect and admiration for the work of art therapists and in the clinical environment. And so I was really, really grateful to have included that. And then, yeah, as you sort of say, it sets the tone for the whole book, because that was something that obviously was important to me, the fact that I was able to do that with a patient. And that, you know, regularly patients would come down to the art room and work with Russ and one another and make art. And because my grounding now is in the field of health humanities, that's a part of, you know, the integration of the arts into the healthcare experience and what the humanities can bring is really important to me. And I wanted in that meta way for the book to sort of echo that.
Do you have your book in front of you?
I do not, actually.
Ah, then I will read this. One of the other comments while since your book has been on my kitchen table is people love the Marie Howe quote. May I read it? Or do you want to grab your book and you read
Oh, no,
it?
You go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is Marie Howe, a poet. And the quote is, "The unendurable happens. You know, people we love and we can't live without are going to die. We're going to die. It's unendurable. Art holds that knowledge. All art holds the knowledge that we're both living and dying at the same time. Art can hold it." Marie Howe. I didn't know Marie Howe's work, but believe me, I'm checking it out further. Thanks for including that quote.
Yeah, she had a brother who died of AIDS, and she did a beautiful, and she was his caregiver at the end of his life, and she did a beautiful book of poems, and actually several books span her time talking about her brother. Yeah.
What's next for you, M.K. Zurich?
Oh, that's a great question. I think, so this book is actually framed by the death of each of my parents. As we talked about, my father, or we didn't talk about this aspect of it, my father had multiple strokes, but then one of the reasons to give away just that beginning of the book, how I ended up in AIDS care, actually has to do with him dying kind of suddenly while I was in nursing school. And as the book was going to press, my mother passed away. Mm-hmm. And so the caregiving that I'd been doing in the last few years while I was working on the book actually involved my mother and her older sister, who just passed away also recently. And so I've been very involved on a very personal level in end-of-life care and hospice care, which is different really than doing it professionally, but of course very complementary. And so a lot of my work now is focused on, and probably my next book focused on, trying to take the same kind of approach I took in Taking Turns, which is sort of combining the theory and some of the thinking in the health humanities about how we talk about and don't talk about end-of-life, and then combining it with memoir and talk about kind of how I negotiated that process with my own mom and aunt and how I thought about what the important work we need to do. And that starts not just when they're in their 90s, but when, you know, our family members and our loved ones every day. Just to kind of how can comics maybe be a part of that conversation about end of life and making it more comfortable or finding comfortable ways to share our wishes and our hopes, and so none of us are left guessing when we have to face this, because, again, to the Marie Howe quote, it's unendurable, but we are going to have to face it. Mm-hmm. And so rather than living in denial, how can we talk about these things? And so that's probably going to be the focus of my work moving forward.
Well, may the memory of your mother and your father and your aunts continue to bless you and all of us through your creation and your work. M.K. Zurich is the author of her newest graphic memoir, Taking Turns, Stories from HIV/AIDS Care Unit 371, published by the Pennsylvania State University Press, just released March 2017. You can follow MK on Twitter at Comic Nurse, and her site is comicnurse.com. Thank you, MK Zurich.
Oh, thank you. It's just a pleasure to speak with you.